time for hour number two of the Bible study, the Ask the Pastor Hour, the hour where you can call with questions or comments. We love to turn the program over to you. Only usually we wind up turning the second half of the program over to you because that's when you wait to call. You can call in the first half hour if you like. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is with us on the telephone for this hour. He is Pastor Daniel Torkelson, pastor at Zion Lutheran Church in Kleiman, Wisconsin. Whenever I get the Wisconsin or Minnesota guys on or North Dakota guys, I always have to ask them about the weather. Just like when we get the Florida guys on, I got to ask them about the hurricanes. So is it cold where you are today, Pastor Kleiman?
You bet. Coming to church yesterday morning was quite the wild wintry blast, as the hymn goes.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's in the 30s today.
That's what we have today. It's 35 here.
Yeah, we're probably going to climb into the low 40s today, but yesterday I don't think we got past the freezing mark.
Refresh my memory here a little bit. Where in Wisconsin are you?
We're right between Milwaukee and Madison.
So southern half.
Yeah, southeastern.
So do you get any of chilling winds that come off the lake there at all?
We're a little too far west for that. A lot of lake effect stuff usually just impacts, for instance, if you're thinking Milwaukee, it mainly just impacts Milwaukee County. But the stuff that comes from the west usually hits us harder.
So how's the ministry going up there?
It's going wonderfully, very, very well.
Good, good. It's good to hear.
Can't complain. No one listens anyway.
All right, let me raise an issue here, that story on the Associated Press, which came up yesterday, that I thought we could discuss here. This comes out of Jerusalem, and the story is Israeli police rushed into one of Christianity's holiest churches on Sunday and arrested two clergymen after an argument between monks erupted into a brawl next to the site of Jesus' tomb. The clash broke out between Armenian and Greek Orthodox monks in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, revered as the site of Jesus' crucifixion, burial, and resurrection. It began as Armenian clergymen marched in an annual procession commemorating the 4th century discovery of the cross, believed to have been used to crucify Jesus. It ended with the arrival of dozens of riot policemen who separated the sides, seizing a bearded Armenian monk in a red and pink robe and a black-clad Greek Orthodox monk with a bloody gash on his forehead. Both men were taken away in handcuffs. This is from the other side of the world, Pastor, and doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the good folks there at Zion Lutheran Church in Kleiman, Wisconsin, or you, Pastor Torkelson. Are you embarrassed by this?
Sure I am. First of all, I'm just trying to picture it. I'm trying to picture Armenian and Greek monks. I know basically how they dress and the sort of distinct look that they have. I'm just trying to even picture this right now in my mind. It doesn't compute. But I mean, on a more basic faith level too, this kind of behavior certainly is not to be expected from Christians at all. I'd be curious to know what the argument was about. Or what caused this riot?
Well, it says, let me read on here. I think maybe we'll get some details on that. It says, the feud revolves around a demand by the Greek Orthodox to post a monk inside the edicule. Not sure I know what an edicule is.
I'm guessing that's part of the building.
It says, yeah, it's defined here as the ancient structure built on what is believed to be the tomb of Jesus during the Armenian procession. The Armenians refused, and when they tried to march, the Greek Orthodox monks blocked their way.
Yeah.
Quote, we were keeping resistance so that the procession could not pass through and establish a right that they don't have, unquote, said a young Greek Orthodox monk with a cut next to his left eye. The monk, who gave his name as Seraphim, said he sustained the wound when an Armenian punched him from behind and broke his glasses. Father Pakrat of the Armenian Patriarchate said the Greek demand was, quote, against the status quo arrangement and against the internal arrangement of the Holy Sepulchre, unquote. He said the Greeks attacked first. Now, somebody listening to us, maybe somebody who's not even a Christian, not a believer, and we have people who are not necessarily believers who listen to our Bible study programs, just shaking their head and saying, "There you go. Look at these Christian people. They're supposed to be the people of Jesus,
right.
And they fight just like kindergartners on the playground."
Yeah, I actually don't think this has anything to do with faith. I think this has to do with feelings of nationalism on both sides, and that they erupted in the wrong place, at the wrong time, in the wrong setting. It'd be one of those things. You certainly could judge their Christian faith if that's what they're going to do, if that's how they're going to act when these nationalistic feelings come to the fore. But this was not I don't think this was at all a theological concern. This was about rules and ethnic pride in a lot of ways. That's what it looks like to me.
Nevertheless, I think you're correct to say. I think you're correct to say that this is going to reach all the way around to Clyman, Wisconsin,
oh, sure.
And impact you. And if you're,
right.
If you found yourself trying to make the case for Christianity to a doubter or a skeptic,
mm-hmm.
And they said, Pastor, I was watching the news over the weekend, and I heard about this business over in Jerusalem. What is wrong with you people? How do you respond to that?
Well, I'd begin with a clear understanding of sin itself. Don't expect Christians to be perfect. On the other hand, do expect Christians to try to visibly show their faith. I don't think it's necessarily fair to judge based on what is probably an ethnic and civic concern that sort of rose to the forefront there, to judge all Christians. I think Christians should be, to some extent, civically concerned. They should be supportive of their nations too, for that matter. But nationalism becomes its own little god, which probably was the case in this particular circumstance, then we have to fall back and recognize that supporting our nation doesn't necessarily mean that we can't work with others in the spirit of love and grace. I'm not so sure why this had to break down into fisticuffs or whatever it was that took place, but generally speaking, the person who says, you Christians, well, don't make such a broad, sweeping generalization about Christians, but that person can be at least granted one point in that you can say, well, you're right, Christians should not behave that way. Those people do not necessarily speak for me and for my people at Zion. We have some pretty patriotic people, though, at Zion, and I think, if you attack their patriotism, they'd probably get upset about it, and I understand that much. I don't think it would break down into that, per se, that kind of fighting.
Some of the things that are described here, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and revered as the site of Jesus' crucifixion, burial, and resurrection, I'm inclined to think that those are three different places. I mean, that they're not just exactly the same place. And the way some of these things are described here almost sound like we're arguing over things that we're not even sure are the facts anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's been a problem throughout the centuries. I don't know how well we can know, for instance, the cross that was mentioned in the news story. How well we can know that really was the cross that Jesus was crucified on. There's a great scene in that movie that came out a few years ago about Luther, where he kind of jokes that there's enough metal from the nails of the cross out there in Christianity to shoe all the horses in Saxony. That's a really great line in the sense that we do perhaps make too big of an ideal out of places and things that they might date back to those days, but I don't know that we truly know that it's the cross that Jesus was crucified on. I don't know if we truly know if that's the place where he was buried. And, when tensions flare up in these places, the tensions are never appropriate, but you've asked a very good question. In the background, what are we saying if we think that this place is such a holy place and maybe isn't? And then on top of it, we besmirch it with really bad behavior. There's a very, very inconsistent message being given just all the way across the board in that situation.
Well, I it seems like when I sit down at my computer and I begin to check a variety of websites, it seems like somehow people who bear the Christian identity every week have found some way to embarrass either themselves or their church body or their Lord, for that matter. But I suspect that if we had representatives of both of these parties sitting right here in the studio talking to us, that they would stick to their guns, would believe that what they were doing was right, and that the other guy is wrong, and the other guy started it, and we'd be stuck with that.
Yeah, we would. We would, and that's unfortunate. When this kind of behavior manifests itself, when any inappropriate or sinful behavior manifests itself in the life of the Christian, the beginning of wisdom really is the fear of the Lord, and I think it's important for us to look at our lives and look at our behavior from a spirit of humility first, so that we, rather than say the other guy did it or it's their fault, we are constantly examining our own behavior and seeing what we could have done differently. The Christian faith begins and ends, I think, in a posture of humility. It ultimately ends in a position of glory in heaven, but as long as we're in this life, we should always, in all circumstances, examine our own behavior first. And I don't think that, the situation you described, if you could put those different people in the radio studio there and talk to them, if they're defending themselves, you can bet that humility is not really part of the argument.
Well, I have to confess that I'm not so sure that I understand what it is from the Greek Orthodox perspective or the Armenian perspective. These things, they're beyond me, but I guess to a certain extent I'm a little bit, I don't know if resentful is the right word, that I should have to be explaining this behavior because we all call ourselves Christians. The same would go for you.
Right, right. But again, don't forget that to be a Christian in this life is to be a combination of saint and sinner. I this is leading into a discussion of those type of people who will tell you, I'm not ever going to go to church because I really don't want to be in with those hypocrites. And whenever I've been approached with that kind of logic, my reply has always been, well, precisely, that's exactly what they are. And that's maybe why they are in church on Sunday morning, because they know that. In our service, we begin with a confession of sins. We come into the Lord's presence and immediately take that position of humility that I just mentioned. We confess our sins, looking for God's forgiveness. The reason to be in church is because we're sinful hypocrites. When someone uses that to judge us, they're not really saying anything about us that isn't still true of them also. So it gets to be a bit self-righteous when you say, well, I'm not going to hang around with Christians because, well, Christians, they're sinners. I tend to think, oh, of course we are. That's not glorifying it, that's not rejoicing in it, but that is at least recognizing that until we're glorified with Christ in heaven, we're not really, we try to be different than everybody else, but we're going to fail at times. And the Christian should know that and admit that up front. Not to use it to justify it, but at least admit it.
All right, Pastor, can I get a little weird with you here?
Sure.
I'm just going to wander off into one foot in la la land here, and I say that with all due respect to the folks who are proponents of what we're about to talk about here. But I grew up when I was a young person. I remember the debut of the late great Planet Earth. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that phenomenon, but Hal Lindsey sold many, many books when he sold the late great Planet Earth. More recently, we have the Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye Left Behind series, which pretty much holds forth that same view of the end times. I can remember when people were speculating as to whether or not Ronald Reagan was the Antichrist, because there were six letters in Ronald, six letters in Wilson, and six letters in Reagan. I can remember when people assigned numerical values to the alphabet, A being 1, B being 2, and down the line, and if you use that with the name Kissinger, that number adds up to 666. The present president, the lame duck president, George W. Bush, once let the words New World Order drop from his lips. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Yes, I do.
We went through all kinds of speculation with George Bush and his affiliation with certain secret societies, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. My first question is, do you run into this in your own pastoral ministry? Are the folks at Zion Climbing insulated from this so that it really doesn't come up very much? Or is this an issue that you and other pastors have to deal with some frequency?
I think it's an issue that probably kind of ebbs and flows. As I look back on my 11 years in the ministry, recently it's been flowing again. Coming into this election, the same kind of things, of course, are being said, particularly about Barack Obama. And I had a lot of email forwards to me, you know, connecting Revelation to the potential election of Barack Obama. I had a neighbor just probably about four or five houses down from me that had a sign on his front lawn, Obama is the Antichrist. And those kind of questions were certainly getting raised a lot to me personally just in the last, I'd say, month and a half to 2 months. My people are certainly not insulated from it. They're thinking about it. That's pretty obvious because I was getting questions regarding that. Unfortunately, you know, I assume you're asking, what do I think of all of this? I tend to think that it may be the American way right now. I don't know why, but it may be the American way to truly overstate your case in order to try to, you know, be convincing to someone else. When someone puts a sign out that says Obama is the Antichrist, I can make a pretty strong argument that that's overstating the case. Until he becomes president and we see exactly what he does, we're not going to know the true righteousness or lack of righteousness to his being president. So I think we're being a little premature. And I also think that connections to Revelation that people were sending me in emails and things like that are just based on so many of the classic misinterpretations of Revelation. I don't want to sound like I'm endorsing him. I'm not necessarily endorsing anyone when I say that, but I am putting the best construction on him based on the Eighth Commandment as well.
And I think that is entirely appropriate. So,
right.
You know, we could just turn our backs on all of these things, New World Order, Ronald Wilson, Reagan, blah, 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 and just go, you know, with a carefree attitude in the rest of our lives. But other people have done those things. There were thousands who celebrated the rise to power of Adolf Hitler, and look what happened there. And you know, there are countless examples of that kind of thing, and so it seems it would behoove one to be vigilant while at the same time not being premature in exercising judgment. So I have two things that crossed my desk in the past week that I want to share with you, and then I want you to think it through for me. And I'm not so much interested in what citizen Torkelson thinks,
right,
what your own private interpretation of these things, but if this is on the minds of your parishioners, or if it comes up in a Bible study, or somebody mentions it to you that it's troubling them, and you're the pastor and you need to react, that's kind of the perspective I'm looking for.
Sure.
I don't know if you saw Meet the Press over the weekend.
No, it's on when I'm doing services.
Well, some people TiVo things, you know.
Okay.
I'm always aware that somebody might have had a chance. And if not the program, perhaps the excerpt that I'm about to share with you. But the co-chair of Barack Obama's transition team, her name is Valerie Jarrett.
Right.
And she appeared on Meet the Press with Tom Brokaw, and they were going through the usual business of the interview when Valerie Jarrett said something rather interesting. It's one important word, and let's listen to this together.
What's the working model? Are you going to try to be a shadow government or just a very interested spectator off to the side?
Well, it's a good question. There is one president at a time. President Bush is still the president. He's graciously invited President-elect Obama to the White House tomorrow to begin their conversations of the transition. So we respect that. He will be the president until January 20th. However, given really the daunting challenges that we face, it's important that President-elect Obama is prepared to really take power and begin to rule day one. So we will be working closely with his administration. We're reviewing the agencies now. He will be making key personnel decisions. He gets national security briefings every day now as well, but he will not be the president until January 20th.
Did anything get your attention there, Pastor Torkelson?
Not necessarily. If you're looking for one word, I didn't hear it. What was the word you were looking for?
The word that got my attention was, we'll take office January 20th and begin to rule on day one.
Yeah.
And
okay.
There might be somebody who's saying, oh, Chuck, come on, you're exaggerating or you're reading too much into it. But I don't know that I can think in my entire life of anybody who would have made a comment like that in the past similar circumstances and said, begin to serve on day one.
Right.
That word rule caught my attention and has caught the attention of others. And I'm wondering, now that I've focused in on it, what your thoughts are.
Well, I would be concerned about that from a pastoral perspective. I prefer to see the president as our president, but I also, from a Christian perspective, a biblical perspective, prefer to see him also as a servant, him or her, as a servant of God and God's purposes. And I would be concerned about a comment like that as I think about it. It kind of shot past my ears when we were listening to the soundbite, but I would be concerned for again. You know, I was talking about humility before.
What's the working model? Are you going to?
Whoops, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. The concern I guess I'd have is just simply that this isn't just about ruling; it is about serving the people in their best interests. And that has been, I mean, that's a concern that's been raised a little bit about Obama. Some of the rhetoric of his speeches kind of lean that way, too. But, again, we have to play a wait and see to see ultimately what kind of attitude he takes. But that's a striking word when you think about it. That's not a, when you said, what's your reaction? Well, I'm concerned that my reaction be, number one, Christian and pastoral. But I am a little afraid of my Americanness here, too. In the sense that we Americans might hear that word and really, you know, really go negative in a hurry, because we Americans are known as not being great with authority.
Well,
just in general.
Amen to that.
So when someone says the word rule, we get uncomfortable. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes that's a bad thing.
Well, you know, when I first saw it, I thought, that's interesting. And then the more I thought about it, the more provocative it seemed to me until I got to the point where I think that was not a good way to phrase it.
Certainly.
All right,
was.
We're going to take our bottom of the hour break. We'll be back with Pastor Daniel Torkelson in just a moment. Here at AM 850 KFUO, we are grateful for those of you who support our radio ministry. Today we want to say thank you to Rose Fox of St. Louis, Marilyn Runge of Granite City, Greg Sprick of Oakville, Missouri, and Marty and Deborah Aubuchon of St. Louis. Your support helps make the programming on AM 850 KFUO possible.
St. Anthony's Medical Center presents a free program, Get Pumped, Get Psyched, Get Motivated. Registered and licensed dietitian Lisa Galati will share information and techniques to help you eat better, exercise regularly, and live a healthier lifestyle. The program is Wednesday, December 10th in the conference room of the Highland Education and Training Center on St. Anthony's campus. This is a free event, but advance registration is required. Call 314-525-4002 or 1-800-554-9550.
Why does the boomerang return? The answer is next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
For many people, the fun of the boomerang lies in the fact that it seems to go against all common sense. You throw the boomerang away from you, and it returns to you. Boomerangs of various shapes and sizes and made of different kinds of materials are easily available in many places around the world. Boomerangs can be made into many other shapes than the classic L shape that we usually think of. They have been made into the shape of a windmill with six blades. Boomerangs have also been made into the shapes of 20 letters of the English alphabet. Contrary to popular myth, boomerangs never were used as weapons by Australian Aborigines. What makes the boomerang return to the thrower? The arms of the boomerang are curved on top and flat on the bottom like an aeroplane wing. So as the boomerang moves through the air, its wings create lift, just like an aeroplane's wings. But as it spins, the edge of the boomerang wing, which is speeding forward in spin, creates more lift than the relatively slower moving opposite arm. This causes the boomerang to tip. As a result of a principle known as gyroscopic precession, this uneven lift causes a constant turning pressure on the boomerang, eventually returning it to the thrower. The boomerang uses sophisticated aerodynamic and physical principles. It clearly was not invented by people who are primitive. Rather, it is a testimony to the intelligence which the Creator gave to every human being, from the first to the last.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Hi, I'm Charlie Harris, president of the Missouri Bar. You know, Missouri faces many new challenges. We need the talents of every person to meet those challenges and build a better Missouri. If we work hard to remove artificial barriers in the courtroom, the boardroom, the schoolroom, we tap into new abilities and solutions hidden by old prejudice. The value of diversity is clear. We all enjoy a better life when every talented, hardworking person can work together.
This message brought to you by the men and women of the Missouri Bar.
AM 850 KFUO listeners are invited to attend the Family Shield Ministries Witnessing a Lifestyle Seminar on Thursday, November 13th in St. Louis. Topics include witnessing basics, witnessing begins at home, witnessing during holidays, and witnessing in the community. It begins at 8:30. Participants will receive a copy of the book, Witnessing a Lifestyle. To learn more, call 314-772-6070.
Back in our Bible study program.
What's the working model? Are you going to try to be a shadow government or just a very interested spectator off to the side?
Well, it's a good question. There is one president at a time. President Bush is still the president. He's graciously invited President-elect Obama to the White House tomorrow to begin their conversations of the transition. So we respect that. He will be the president until January 20th. However, given really the daunting challenges that we face, it's important that President-elect Obama is prepared to really take power and begin to rule day one. So we will be working closely with his administration. We're reviewing the agency.
It's very important that President Barack Obama be ready to take power and rule on day one. I'm a little bit troubled by the way that was phrased by Valerie Jarrett, who is a co-chair of his transition team. And I really wanted to play that for Pastor Daniel Torkelson to get a gauge on whether he or not he thinks that I'm overreacting. And I didn't sense that you thought that I was. How do you see it?
How do I see it? I see it as I'm not so sure it's an innocent mistake. I think that oftentimes we speak in ways that ultimately reflect the way we're looking at this. I do feel that, you know, when you've been elected to, you know, to be the most powerful man in the free world and whatever, it's not hard to see the power aspect of it and to let that sort of govern the way you're looking at it. I don't think it was an innocent mistake. I also think, though, that before we draw too many deep conclusions about the Obama administration, we need to let it work and see what it's going to do and how it's going to act. So at this point, it raises a red flag, but I would need to see probably a few red flags before I've ultimately concluded that this is just all about power and rule.
Now, I had this other... The first time I saw this press release, I thought to myself, oh, that's kind of wacky, and I set it aside. This is a press release that we received here, sent to us by Dan Smith, who does the publicity for a gentleman by the name of Jim Stark. He has written a book, and the subject line of the email says, interview on One World Government. Expert explains why it will, and will is in all caps, why it will happen. And then the email says, author Jim Stark doesn't simply endorse and discuss the idea of one democratic world government, but has created a specific plan for its creation. He is credentialed and very serious. The author, Jim Stark, says, quote, I fully anticipate watching the inaugural session of a directly elected world parliament on TV by the year 2018, unquote.
Wow, that's close.
That's 10 years away. The release says to Jim Stark, it's simple. We are on a clear course toward omnicide, a human-caused extinction of our species and most of life forms on Earth. He is not alone in this opinion. None other than Albert Einstein, citing the unleashing of the atom bomb, said we, quote, drift toward unparalleled catastrophe, unquote. While nuclear weapons continue to be developed by countries around the world and the prospect of dangerous or abrupt climate change sinks into our awareness, that drift has become a surge, and we do not have the competent supranational institutions needed to deal effectively with global issues. The only viable solution, a democratic world government. Stark is the author of the forthcoming book, Rescue Plan for Planet Earth, Democratic World Government Through a Global Referendum. He is the first person to not simply endorse and discuss the idea of a democratic world government, but to lay out a specific plan for its creation. What do you think?
I'm going to probably sound a bit cynical here, and I really don't mean to be, but... Do you really think that some of the megalomaniacs that run some of the nations of the world would ever consent to this? I'm sorry, but if he's talking 10 years down the road, I don't see it. But if he were talking 200 to 500 or 1,000 years down the road, I'm not so sure that sinful human nature, just on a worldwide global scale, would ever really consent to this. I think too much pride enters into it. If we go back to the story that you led with at the beginning of the show, if you could get those two groups of Christian monks together on the same page, you might be accomplishing a tremendous miracle. I don't see it. I think this is quite unrealistic, based on just my understanding of sin and its play in the world.
Well, in the wake of the election and alongside the context of Valerie Jarrett and her comments on Meet the Press of the transition of power and President Obama beginning to rule on day one, there have been some other hints about global cooperation and perhaps the United States spending money on facilitating some of these things that heretofore, through the Bush administration or previous administrations, have not been attempted. And while it's quite a stretch from that to one democratic world government, there does appear to be something of a trend here, does there not?
Oh, definitely. And, it's funny. It's funny that you should bring this up, because I know in my own personal thinking, I've been thinking about this more in just the last couple of days since the election. It dawns on me that the economic crisis, for instance, in the United States, does present a very interesting opportunity for many of the nations of the world to make certain amends, I guess you could say, as they work together to try to stabilize the more global economy. It may prove to work to President Obama's, President-elect Obama's advantage. to work in that kind of spirit for the good of, you know, all the nations that have been affected by this crisis. And I was surprised to find out recently that, or I think it was in today's headlines, that even China now has jumped in and taken on a stimulus package of its own, because they're feeling it as well. It was generally thought, I think, that China was immune. And we noticed that in our family because we adopted a Chinese boy last year. But China apparently is not immune either. So this gives an opportunity for the world to work together on a common mission. But once the economy is stabilized, if we expect it to just remain harmonious, I just think you've got, you know, thousands of years of world history and the doctrine of original sin working pretty significantly against you. In order to hold to a one-world government, you do have to take... It's interesting, you have to take a utopian view, but I think it's interesting that this view begins with that position of omnicide, as it's called. Is that a risk in this fallen world? Sure. But I tend to think that if we ever, you know, sent the missile codes, I have an uncle who was a Missouri Synod pastor who used to say, if they ever push the missile codes, Christ is coming back. I don't know if he was right, but it... If you were to look at the scriptures, you might be able to make that argument. I don't know.
Well, it is a chilling thing just to have this conversation, I think.
Yeah, it sure is.
505-780-1800-730-2727. Harold, you're on the Bible study.
Yes. About President-elect, when it comes to President Obama, immediately can come forth with a number of things there that are going to have our eyes wide open on, and that's issuing executive orders, especially rescinding some of President Bush's executive orders. Why, he could start after he's sworn in there and he's ride down to the White House, he can start to issue right away. For instance, one of the executive orders that will disturb a lot of people is Bush says there should be no U.S. funds used overseas to support abortion things. And there's a whole host of other things that that he can issue that will really change things. And he doesn't have to wait for Harry Reid and Pelosi to get the Democratic Congress to hold forth. He can immediately issue these executive orders and make some wide sweeping changes.
All right, let's see what the pastor has to say. Pastor?
Right, that's true. And this goes back to that part of the discussion where we were talking about, should the president take a servant's mindset or a power mindset? And certainly the use of executive orders probably has been abused by every president throughout history and been reflective of that sort of power mindset more than of a service mindset. I'm sure they've been used in the past with a servant's heart as well, but that is the fear. And I even heard in the news today the possibility, and this would be very unpopular with me and with many Christians, the notion of an executive order coming from President-elect Obama to start government funding of stem cell research. That's pushing the ethical, biblical envelope, and I don't know. I guess I'm a big enough believer in, my secret passion, and I guess not so secret passion, is the study of history. And I don't know that, you know, history is always a good textbook for predicting the future, but if I were to use history to kind of look into the crystal ball just a little bit, my inclination is to say, though, if there's a succession of very unpopular decisions, just kind of like 1994, the American public does have a tendency to pull back and balance things out again. But I don't know. That is to be feared. It's to be feared with any president. And I think how the president behaves will dictate to us whether or not he sees himself as a servant or as a ruler.
This press release from author Jim Stark, which is soliciting an interview from whatever radio stations where it goes, says, in a one-of-a-kind interview, Stark can discuss the following points. Number one, political tools available which can be used to persuade nations to support a democratic world government. Point two, exactly how the Internet can be legitimately used for a global referendum to serve as the launching pad for the creation of a democratic world government. Point 3, how a democratic world government can be totally transparent and therefore free of corruption. Point 4, why citizens will actually pay less in total taxes when a DWG is in place. Point 5, how a democratic world government can function with the United Nations still intact. And point 6, maybe the most troubling to me, a proposed process for the expedited construction of a world constitution. Now, Pastor, this guy might just be cashing in on the fascination that we have, particularly Christians, with the end of the world and one world government and all the things that were advanced by Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins as a formidable turn of events at some point in the not-too-distant future. It could maybe sell some books, make some money, and retire early. Maybe that's what it's about. Maybe he is very serious and is hopeful that by 2018 we will all be living under a one-world, democratically elected leader, and it'll be great. I'm not sure. How do you see it?
Well, I'm just really taken with the stark contradictions lurking behind what you just read, and they're pretty stark when you think about it. You began a while ago talking about omnicide and the notion that man is on this track to, you know, just outrageous destruction. If that's the sort of negative premise from which this man is operating, and then he wheels around and starts talking as utopian as the stuff you just read for me, the points you just read for me, a part of me now is inclined to just say, based on reason alone, which is it going to be? Are we living in the perfect world, or are we living in a world that's on its way to destruction? Now, as a Christian, I've got a quick answer for that. And the quick answer for that is that things are not going to get better before Christ comes again. Things are on their way downward. They probably have been throughout history, which is why every generation, to some extent, tends to think that, you know, every Christian generation, I should say, tends to think they're living in the last times. So I tend to think that the Christian message here is far more consistent. It's got a sort of one position policy on this that says, yeah, the world is working its way toward destruction, no question about that. When it gets down to, you know, what's going to happen in the world with regard to government or whatever, we, you know, leave that question alone. But I'm just absolutely shocked at the they're just glaring contradictions lying behind this thinking. I would hope that people would pass that book on the shelves. If they're listening to this program, would pass that book on the shelves for that very reason. This man's not consistent, I think, in his argument at all.
Well, as I think this through, based on what we've seen of sort of global remedies and proposals like this one, whether it be Marx and Lenin or, you know, pick your poison.
Yeah.
What I can see here is a trend toward working against oppression as it appears globally. Take oppression against women, for example. And if you and I are not willing to pay for abortions for women all around the globe, then we're oppressive. And we need to be straightened out. We need sensitivity training. We need to rethink our model. Maybe we need, who knows, shock treatment. But if we're really good people and followers of Jesus, then we will work hard to see to it that every woman in the world has access to abortion on demand. I can see that coming.
Well, I can too, and there's false premises behind that as well. I mean, the notion of course, just seeing this through the eyes of women rather than, you know, trying to see it through the eyes of fetuses and through the eyes of God and the value of life, obviously it's a very one-dimensional argument. This reared its ugly head during the presidential campaign, quite interestingly, when certain people made comments about Sarah Palin having that last child that she had who has Down syndrome. Why didn't she go ahead and have an abortion was actually stated in the press by, I believe it was a member of Congress or something, I don't recall, but I remember I was deeply offended by that. And the reason I was, not only has to do with my values as a Christian and my feelings about pro-life, but I worked for 12 years at Bethesda Lutheran Homes and Services in Watertown, Wisconsin, with the developmentally disabled, with many, many people who have Down syndrome. And the judgments that go into such thinking about the quality of that person's life are absolutely wrong. I mean, just absolutely. Some of the happiest people I've ever known had Down syndrome. And granted, they don't have a long life expectancy and some other realities, but had Sarah Palin had an abortion because she knew this child was going to have Down syndrome, she would have had that abortion based on absolutely incorrect assumptions about the life of that child. And generally speaking, when we start talking about abortion only in terms of, you know, not oppressing women, we are definitely looking at this from a one-dimensional point of view.
Well, of course, the obvious implication in the policy that I just stated, which may have seemed liberating if we could get curmudgeons like you and me to get on board with financing and funding abortion on demand for women across the globe so that they can be relieved of that oppression, by following that course, we have placed unborn human beings under the worst oppression perhaps that's ever existed, given the millions of people who have died in that way.
Absolutely.
505-780-5180-730-2727. If you want to change the subject, you're welcome to do that. Let's talk with Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the Bible study.
Good morning, gentlemen. My phone's kind of giving me trouble. So can you hear me all right?
I can, yes.
Okay, I'd like to ask a question about the book of Daniel. I was reading it this morning. And on the 70-week prophecy, and I think it was Michael that revealed the 70 weeks to him, and it comes down to add up to 69 weeks. But including in that is till when the Messiah gets cut off. So can he give me his explanation on that and key in on the Messiah being cut off? Thank you very much.
All right, we'll talk about it. We only got about 4 minutes here. That sounds like a half-hour question. But who better
really
to ask than Pastor Daniel Torkelson?
It really is a half-hour question, but the 70 weeks, of course, numbers in apocalyptic books, like in the second half of the book of Daniel and in Revelation, take on a symbolic form. I would take that. I haven't looked at that section of Scripture in a while. I was in Daniel this morning with my kids, but Daniel's got some of the best Sunday school material, and it's some really great stories, and I was in there in the front part of it with my kids, but I would just simply say that 70 weeks probably are symbolic, because 7 is a number of completion of really what I would call the fullness of time, the fullness of time leading right up to the return of Christ. And in the last days, the very last days before Christ returns, there's going to be a time where, as promised, the Antichrist is going to appear to be ruling with much more authority than Christ. Things are not going to, as he has described it, we're not living in a world that's getting better and better. It's only getting worse and worse. And at the very end, in between that sort of, the period between the 69th and 70th year, if I'm recalling the section of Scripture correctly, that's a period which I think we've technically called it the little season. And it's not a good time. It's a very bad time where Christ's voice is going to be hard to hear, leading right up to his return, when his voice will be the only one we hear. So rest assured, my friends, if we're moving into the little season, it does have a happy ending.
All right.
For the faithful.
just a couple of minutes left here. One more question on the conversation that we were having as it pertains to democratic world government.
Right.
It seems that there have been a number of writers and thinkers and philosophers over the centuries who have postulated the possibility of some kind of one world government where we all link arms and sing kumbaya and live happily ever after. It seems to me that in order to advance that kind of notion, you necessarily have to have a high view of man. That is, that the evil man or the criminal man is really the exception, and most all of humanity is really good. And if allowed to prevail, will take us to that utopia that you described before. But I don't think that the Christian faith allows for that kind of view, or does it?
No, absolutely not. That's when I've been reacting to the one world government discussion here, I've been mentioning two factors. One is the doctrine of original sin, and the other is history. But ultimately, as Christians, it is the doctrine of original sin that should be ringing in our ears as we contemplate even the possibility of pulling together like that. I just think world history, being as divided as it is actually just a reflection of that. It's a reflection of sin, you know, throughout history, and the fact that humans cannot so easily pull together to create our own heavens. We try to every day. That's a part of our sinful nature to believe that we can, but it's not the case. In fact, if we could have heaven now, or if we could create a utopia now, we certainly wouldn't need it for the next life. So the idea of a one-world government and a worldly utopia, this certainly is not consistent at all with a scriptural viewpoint.
So in the 30 seconds that remain, mm-hmm. How is one vigilant without being crazy? I mean, you know, watching the headlines, listening to the various news reports, you know, you can see a devil behind every rock if you want to. And we don't want to commit that error either.
Right. I always think of Paul's instruction here. It's not Paul. Test the spirits. Oh, gosh. You caught me. I just quoted the scriptures, and I'm not exactly sure which one I quoted. Test the spirits. I mean, what's out there, you've got to test based on the Word of God. The Christians have one authority and one authority only, and that is the voice of God in the Scriptures. And against the Scriptures, we can see what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly. Not everything's a mystery. You can decipher what's going on in the world and have a faithful outlook in the midst of absolute craziness when one sticks to the Word of God.
Thank you, Pastor Torkelson. I threw you a couple of fastballs there.
You sure did. It was fun.
I appreciate the conversation.
All right, you too.
Pastor Daniel Torkelson, he is pastor at Zion Lutheran Church in Clyman, Wisconsin. Our guest here on our Ask the Pastor program tomorrow. We begin 1 Peter chapter 1 with Pastor John Lukomsky, and our Ask the Pastor guest will be Pastor Don Moore from St. Paul Lutheran Church in Apopka, Florida.
You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.